Good afternoon, America. Welcome to Mark Levine's Inside Scoop on Washington, where we bring you all the news from the nation's capital that the government does not want you to know. I'm your host, Mark Levine, and I want to talk today about a story that all too few Americans know anything about, and yet it is almost certainly the worst humanitarian crisis on the globe today. No, I'm not talking about a tornado, an earthquake, a hurricane, even a famine. I'm talking about the kind of inhumanity that occurs when man is inhumane to man. I'm talking about the worst evil, really, one can imagine, and that is mass murder. And not just mass murder, but mass murder to try to wipe out an entire people, the kind that many have called genocide. Now, we've seen genocide many times in this century, beginning with the Armenian genocide in the first part of the 20th century. I should say last century. This is, I guess, the first genocide of the new 21st century. In the 20th century, we saw the Armenian genocide in Turkey. Then we had the Great Holocaust that killed one-third of all Jews worldwide. And then in the 90s, we had the genocide or the attempted genocides in Rwanda and in Bosnia. And the Clinton administration, to its discredit, did nothing about the genocide in Rwanda. True, it happened very quickly over a period of months. Many of us called for something to be done, but by the time the Clinton administration did anything, it was too late. And Bill Clinton has apologized for that. To its credit, the Clinton administration did do something about Bosnia, the killing at that point by the Serbs of the Bosnian Muslims. And the United Nations, of course, did nothing. European nations did nothing. They even set up safe havens, supposedly, where people could be safe from genocide, and their killers went in those safe havens and killed them there. So Bosnia is a much better example. Well, today, the genocide, and this, again, is my term, not necessarily the term of the administration or of those in charge, and we're going to talk at length about why we should or shouldn't use the term genocide. But now what's going on in Sudan, it seems to me, is becoming a genocide. What's going on in Sudan is that the Arabs of the north are systematically killing the blacks of the south. It's not actually necessarily a religious war. The blacks that are being killed, are, my understanding, are both Christian and Muslim, but it is a racial war of the worst kind. And while America's attention is focused on Iraq, while the administration's attention is focused on Iraq, we have perhaps genocide going on under our noses. And to tell us about it, we actually did a show about this a few months ago, but I really think it's an important topic to keep in the front of the American mind. We have to understand that an administration that claims that we're in Iraq for humanitarian reasons won't say it's about oil. Used to say it's about weapons of mass destruction. Now we know that's not true. Used to say it was about Al-Qaeda. Now we know it's not true. So now they say it's for humanitarian reasons. Okay. Then why aren't we intervening in the most humanitarian disaster on the planet, what's going on in Sudan? And to tell us about it is a real expert in this field. His name is Jim Jennings. He is the founder and president of Conscious International, a non-government organization, a worldwide organization that seeks out helping in humanitarian situations. And I hope you'll take the chance to call in and find out what's going on in Sudan. The numbers are 877-57-SCOOP. Toll free, 877-57-SCOOP, or you can always send an email to comment@radioinsidescoop.com. Mr. Jennings, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Yes, good afternoon, Mark.
Tell me a little bit about your organization before we get into what's going on in Sudan.
Well, Conscious International started in the early 90s as a volunteer organization to link up needs and resources. It was exactly the kind of situation you're describing, where the world was too busy or too otherwise occupied to be bothered by helping out in crisis situations when some people who, especially those who knew the areas well, knew that something dreadful was going on. And so we took volunteer medical teams. We carried a lot of medicine and shipped medicine into war zones and situations and throughout the Middle East and Central Africa and South Asia and parts of Central Asia.
And how long has your organization been around?
It's been around actually since 1991, but we started first doing this in 1982.
And when did your organization first get involved in the country of Sudan?
In Sudan in 1996.
Tell me what brought you to Sudan.
Well, we were doing maternal child health training, and we had meetings there with all the health ministers and the Interior Ministry and the various factions that run the government. It was really quite an experience just at that time, because they wanted help, but the government was had just taken over. The radical Islamic government had taken over, and it was like being in Algeria or someplace where so much. For example, I was arrested by the death squads. We had to drive through,
wow,
on another occasion, a hail of gunfire in one village just to get out of there. Many humanitarian disasters, not in terms of the fighting, but even floods of the Nile River that washed out roads and railroads and villages, and we were working there with them.
Well, now, Sudan is one of those countries that's sort of on the periphery of most Americans' consciousness. They might remember that Bill Clinton bombed a Sudanese factory after the embassy bombings in Tanzania and Kenya. They might remember that Osama bin Laden actually resided in Sudan before seeking residence in Afghanistan. Could you give us, please, just a short history on Sudan, at least the government, and who's in charge and how they got there?
Yes, indeed. You know, Sudan is the largest country in Africa. It's 2.5 million square miles. And the population estimate's been growing rapidly, but it's estimated now around 30 million. But if you go there, you'll find that only about 4 million of those people even have electricity. So the others are actually living in what might be called the medieval way of living. There have been the longest running conflict in Africa has been the South Sudan conflict for the last 20 years.
Who is fighting in that conflict and why?
Well, the government in Khartoum, the capital in the north, is fighting against the SPLA, or the Sudan People's Liberation Army, which is mainly representing those black Africans in the south who are Christians, and many of them are still animists. And they have been brutally suppressing those people for a long time. And this caused the SPLA to form up cadres, and they began to fight and do the same thing, essentially. So a lot of human rights violations on either side, but observers unanimously say that the greatest crimes have been those done by the central government. In addition,
yeah,
because the radical Islamists took over in a took power in a coup in 1989, slavery was reinstituted because it's allowed in the Sharia, which is the Muslim religious law, and it's believed that now up to 200,000 people have been enslaved, and that's after the world got rid of slavery in the 19th century.
I'd like to give a short geography lesson, if I could, just so our listeners who maybe haven't seen a map of Africa recently can picture it. Africa, as you may well know, the northern part of Africa, the part around the Mediterranean, is populated primarily by Arab peoples, by people from Arabia. They're mostly Muslim. And then, of course, there's the largest desert in the world, the Sahara Desert, which is just south of the Mediterranean. It's a large expanse where very few people live. And then south of the Sahara is what's called Black Africa, because there are blacks, people of the black racial group, who are there, and they're very different people from the Arabs. They practice animism, which is a tribal religion. They also, some of them are Christian. Some of them are Muslim as well. And in fact, perhaps the only bridge, or the main bridge, if you will, between Black Africa and the Arab nations to the north of Africa is the Nile River, which is, I believe, the largest river in the world. And it starts down in Black Africa and is actually goes through the Sahara Desert and then ends in Egypt. Now, the reason why this is important is that Sudan is the only nation, well, maybe it's not the only nation, but the primary nation, the largest nation, certainly, that encompasses both the northern Arab areas and the southern black areas. And I think that this has been, you know, there's been some conflict between these two cultures throughout history. Maybe you could tell us, Mr. Jennings, what percentage of Sudan is, shall we say, Arab, and what percentage is black?
Yes, the Arab peoples are 45%. Now, it's not so much skin color, although it's true that throughout Africa, the further south you go into Central Africa, for example, the skin color gets darker. But even in the north, the people who are called Arabs are not I mean, they're a darker color than the Arabs in Egypt, for example. But 45% of the people speak Arabic, and I think it's the Arabic language that distinguishes them.
So and, it's about half and half, and it's primarily a cultural difference then.
Exactly. Well, it is racial and cultural, but the tribes in the south are mostly what you call Nilotic peoples. There are 90 different tribes, the Dinka, the Nuer, the Shiluk, and those. Then there are others who are Sudanic, and they're Nubians, and the Fur, Masalit, and the Zagawa. Those three groups that I just mentioned are the ones that are being attacked in this terrible situation, the crisis that is going on there now.
Okay, so let's bring it up to the present day. I know that Sudan was controlled by the British, as was much of Africa and the Middle East up until World War II. And then Sudan became independent, what, in the 50s, 60s or so?
Yes, in 56, I believe.
Sounds about right. And then who ruled it that time?
Well, one of the long-term rulers has been Numeri, who has ruled for decades in Africa. And he is probably the most popular politician still, even though he's out of power now and has some health problems. And yet he did some very backward things. Linked up with certain of the radical parties and caved into them, and is the one who first said, well, it's okay if you go ahead and introduce Sharia law. Once that was done, then the radical Islamists took over in 1989, and the Islamist party was led by a theoretician named Hassan al-Turabi, and he backed Omar al-Bashir, who's now the present strongman in Sudan and the president of the country.
Okay, so you had a relatively moderate, or I guess by the Arab standards, there's not really any moderates, but at least he wasn't a radical, let's say, Islamic leader on through about 89. And then was there a coup d'état or
yes,
an
a coup, and Turabi, the Islamist party, backed Omar al-Bashir. They later fell out, and part of what's happening in the south right now is caused by their rivalry, because Turabi was put in prison for a while, and then is out now and has his own party. But there are two of the armies that are fighting in the south against the central government that seem to be inspired at least by Turabi. And what the raiders who are destroying these villages and burning and killing people and raping the women are shouting as they race through the village is that Omar al-Bashir is God. You have no God. You don't, even though they're Muslims, they say you don't celebrate Ramadan or observe Ramadan, and therefore you are corrupt and we'll kill you. But it's really a ethnic cleansing grab and a land grab to wipe out these people.
Okay, now
very distressing.
The strong man's name, what's his name again, please?
Omar al-Bashir.
Omar al-Bashir. And he took power in 89 and is still in power today?
Right. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, what has happened from 89 till today? I mean, has the situation gotten worse? What is causing this? Do they want to convert these black Africans? Do they want to just kill them? What is the animus behind the genocide?
The main thing is they want. I think this particular leader wants to retain power and to control the country as it was left to him by the British. It seems the British made a mistake in the 19th century by not making a separate entity out of South Sudan, because they've had trouble, a lot of trouble since that time. But I think to get the broader picture and to see the real history of it, as I say, Sudan, the largest country in Africa, there have been 2 million deaths
from
war, genocide, famine since 1983. And before this particular Islamist government took power, there were periodic famines about every 4 years, and the world I think sheds crocodile tears in a way. They don't really put enough money, the world's governments, there's not the political will to put enough money to save these people from famine and to stabilize the situation there. And so it has turned in to a veritable genocide. But if you can imagine these 2 million deaths, and now we think that about 30,000 have been killed in the last year or year and a half, and 2.2 million people have been affected by this terrible conflict that's going on. There are about 6.5 million people in the southern province or southwestern province called Darfur, which is where this genocide is taking place. And about 1.2 million have become displaced from their homes because their villages were burned. And the mechanism that's used here is the central government will come in and bomb the village with airplanes, and then they'll send these horsemen in because there are no roads really that are decent. And the men on horseback and on camelback will, just like Bedouin raiders, will come in, set fire to the village and kill the men, rape the women. And some of the stories that have come out of there, Mark, are just astonishing. Like women, stomachs cut open and they're pregnant, their baby taken out and killed. Women whose children were taken out of their arms and their throat cut in front of their eyes. Some of the young men in the village caught and tied up and bundled and thrown into the fire. The standard policy, which Amnesty International issued a report on recently, is rape used as an instrument of war. And it's to humiliate the people, to show their powerlessness. And the people doing this are saying, you are slaves, and you have no, we have control over you, we can do anything with you we like.
You know, I've often studied various genocides, whether it's the Nazi Holocaust, whether it's the Armenian genocide, and more recently in Rwanda. In fact, I've talked with some people on the Truth Commissions in Rwanda, and it seems that it's actually hard. It's obviously a lot harder to understand the killers than the victims. I think it's fairly easy to understand the victims. The killers in those conflicts learn to basically treat the other as something horrible. The Nazis treated Jews as vermin, as this disease, pestilence. In Rwanda, you had cases where they really did think, at least some of them said they did, that the other tribe was out to get them, was out to destroy them, and it was a matter of attacking them first. What is, again, if you could explain, the animus? Is it that they just believe that blacks are designed to be slaves and they're not, and is that the reason?
Well,
what's
again,
going on
the,
here?
The skin color is not that great, although obviously the darker-skinned people are in the south of Sudan. Those who have studied genocide, and it's a good question, have come to the conclusion that if you can dehumanize people first, you can do anything to them. You can kill them, you can torture them. Now, just take the example of the American GIs in Iraq.
Yep.
If they were taught by higher-ups in authority in our government that these people are terrorists and deserve to be killed, and then obviously, torture is fine. And I just saw a report today that a survey it came out that 45% of Americans, let me get it straight, about 33% of Americans think it's fine to torture people. And 45% think that it's fine to torture them mentally, like telling them that you've killed their family and so they are going to be killed too.
Or attaching electrodes to certain body parts and telling you, saying you're going to turn them on.
So the point is, you can, if you dehumanize people, you can do that. And it's been pointed out that it starts with the ethnic joke. If you can make a joke about people that's not very serious, then the next step is you make it seriously, and then the next step, if you get power over them, to do it. It's really hard to understand how humans can do this, but it is done. And you didn't mention the Cambodian genocide.
Excuse me. Absolutely. You're right to point that out. I did not mention the Cambodian genocide, and I should have. That was, of course, a very gruesome one that we helped set the conditions for by making it anarchy, but, of course, it was Pol Pot and the Khmer Rouge. And you're absolutely right to point that out.
It's hard to believe that in our lifetime so many millions of people have been the victim of this sort of thing. I mean, in Africa, you really start with Biafra. When the northern tribes in Nigeria were isolated and starved, and that happened during the 60s, and again, not much was done because people were wringing their hands and people were dying. Then in Rwanda, as you mentioned, and now in Sudan and Darfur province.
You know, it's particularly striking after all the people saying never again after the Holocaust, that Cambodia, Bosnia, Rwanda, and now Sudan is going on. One of the things that actually we learned, I took a course when I was at Harvard, at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government, on the world food system. And I found, to my surprise, that in modern times, famines are almost entirely political events. I had thought, I guess, without even really thinking about famines, that famines were, you know, just people don't have enough food, and it's a bad year, that, you know, the crops are bad, and so people die. What I really came to understand from this course was that certainly in modern times, and probably even way back to the Irish potato famine, but certainly in modern times, Famines are a conscious political thing going on. In North Korea, in China, it's because of politicians, it's because of leaders of countries that people die of starvation. There's more than enough food worldwide to feed everyone.
And that's right.
And famines are indeed just a more subtler form of murder, and I don't think a lot of people understand that.
It's very often linked to war and conflict, and you notice that those who have the guns never starve.
Right.
And so that it is a political event as much as a natural event. I mean, there are cycles of rainfall and lack of rainfall, but there is plenty of food, as you say, and if there's the political will, you can get it to the people, and or you can move them out to a place where they can get food. And then it's much better not to have people displaced, because when that happens, then disaster will follow. I mean, there are 1.2 million people displaced now. The 155 villages that have shown evidence of burning from satellite photos, about 170,000 people managed to flee to Chad. As we said, 30,000 have been killed, but they expect another 350,000 to die if this situation goes on for the next year. So the question is, what are we going to do for the next year? The situation right now is dire.
I just met yesterday
with some people who just came from Sudan, and we're planning a mission ourselves there, and they told us how terribly dreadful this was, even though they had worked in crises all over the world.
Mr. James, we have to take a quick break. I'll also give our listeners a chance to call in, which I hope they'll do. But when we come back, I want to hear what you think should be done about the situation in Sudan. And I also want to talk about other institutions. What is the United Nations doing or not doing? What is our country, the United States, what are we doing or not doing? And does it matter whether we call it genocide? If you want to call in and ask these questions or others, the number is 877-57-SCOOP. I always encourage you to call in. We appreciate your calls here on the Inside Scoop. 877-57-SCOOP. It's a toll-free number. Or you can always send an email to comment@radioinsidescoop.com. I've already got lots of your comments. We'll ask those of Jim Jennings as well. And then finally, at the end of the hour, we're going to have the Inside Scoop on the administration's plans to find some very important al-Qaeda leaders during the Democratic National Convention. That's the Inside Scoop at the end of the hour, and you'll want to tune in for that. We'll be back with more of The Scoop right after this.
What's wrong with you people? Don't you know that the economy is humming? That our very own president has declared mission accomplished on his promise of prosperity? That the stock market is up by 40% over last year? That jobs are cropping up like crabgrass? That the bluebird of happiness is officially singing everywhere across our land? And that you should be grateful, for God's sake? Republican politicians, corporate economists, and the media barons are totally befuddled these days because their economic statistics tell them that the economy is in great shape. Yet you wretches, are still grumpy, even giving Bush the lowest marks of his presidency for his economic stewardship. George himself has gone into one of his high-pitched whines, chastising those who can't see the sunshine. He's sounding a whole lot like his daddy did back in 92. Like he's just another rich son of a Bush who is totally oblivious to the realities of America's workaday majority. He's looking at rosy economic indicators handed to him by his political operatives, rather than looking at such real-life pocketbook indicators as jobs that only pay poverty wages, gasoline topping $2 a gallon, milk at $4.43 a gallon, health care costs rising three times faster than wages, and 401ks being shrunk to 1ks. Also with their heads in the clouds are such media powers as the New York Times, which recently bemoaned the public's economic gloom, referring to it as a mood. A mood? Your job's being downsized or offshored, your kids can't afford to go to college, Bush is trying to cut your Social Security benefits and raise your retirement age to 70, and they think you're moody? Meanwhile, a clueless Republican Senator, Jim Talent of Missouri, blithely says that prosperity is everywhere, but, quote, it just takes a while longer for that to filter through to folks. This is Jim Hightower saying, filter this, Senator. We'll believe the economy is humming when we are.
38%.
46%.
42%.
I cut my payments in half.
How much can you cut your monthly student loan payments by refinancing with College Loan Corporation? To find out, just call 1-800-2-COLLEGE. You'll quickly be connected to an expert loan consultant who will answer your questions and tell you how you can cut your monthly payment by up to 50% by refinancing your federal student loans at rates as low as 2.63%. 1-800-2-COLLEGE. It's the smartest call you can make.
You know, out here in West Texas, it gets really hot, and it's a tough, dry heat.
Glenn Austell of Lubbock, Texas, talks about Gold Bond medicated powder.
When I'm working outside, my skin gets itchy and irritated. I guess you call it a heat rash or something like that. But Gold Bond relieves the itch and irritation and gives me a cool, refreshing sensation. I'm telling you, once you've tried Gold Bond, you can't live without it.
Gold Bond medicated powder cools and soothes heat rash and irritated skin. Use as directed.
I mean, who wouldn't want to feel cool and refreshed?
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine. We're discussing what is going on in Sudan. I call it genocide, the worst crime that man can do to man. And I've received a whole spate of emails from you. You're also welcome to call in at 877-57-SCOOP. Toll-free number, 877-577-2667, 877-57-SCOOP. But I've got a whole host of emails here, and it's interesting that all of you seem to go on the same two themes, and that is, what is the United Nations doing? What is the United States doing? I'd like to read some of those emails to you and to my guest, Jim Jennings, the president and founder of Conscious International, and see what he thinks the United Nations or United States are or should be doing. Mr. Jennings, let me read to you some of these emails I got.
Yes, go ahead.
One, the Sudan situation is a crisis where the UN should already be. Another example why the UN gets no respect in having the power of enforcement, even from its larger proponent, the United States. Here's another one. It says, if the United States had a Department of Peace, it would be the duty of the Secretary of Peace to see that Sudan-like crises are not backburned and ignored. Here's another email. It says, no doubt the U.S. should do something to help in Sudan. I think the rest of the world shouldn't wait for the United States. It's bad enough the U.S. isn't doing anything. I mean, what do people expect from a Republican administration? But why aren't any other countries doing anything, like France, Germany, Russia? These countries are quick to criticize the U.S., yet they fail to act themselves. I think this is an opportunity to show up the other nations and remind why the United States has its responsibilities as the world's only superpower. I think this shows the hypocrisy of religious and political leaders of these and other countries. Then there's a comment from Ben, who agrees something needs to be done in Sudan, but he thinks that France, Russia, and Germany need to step to the plate and do something. We have other issues we are dealing with right now, and let's face it, we need to protect America before we police the rest of the world. I think we should offer support to other countries in Sudan, but we cannot be the primary force. And finally, one last email by James Avery from Cincinnati. And he writes that, I hate the fact the UN has not done more to help Sudan. Many of my friends from the right point to this fact as an excuse for why the current administration invaded Iraq without participation from the UN. What can we do to fix the UN instead of abandoning it like the right wants? And why won't the UN classify this as genocide and do something to help these people? Well, that's a lot of questions for you, Mr. Jennings. Let's just deal with it step by step, one by one. And let's start with the United Nations, since that seems to be brought up by a lot of people. What has the UN done in Sudan, and what should they be doing?
Well, they have been intervening to the extent of talking with the government. They've also, the World Food Program is the major supplier of food and transporter of food into the region, basically from Chad, and I believe they've had permission now to do work in Darfur as well, although the security situation is not very good. In that sense, the UN does things that maybe nobody else will do. I think that the UN is a weak and sometimes ineffective organization, depending on the leadership and the political will at the Security Council level. But let's not forget that without the UN, the second half of the 20th century might well have been like the first half. And if you remember World War I and World War II, and the millions upon millions of people, tens of millions, who died as a result of those conflicts, we can be thankful that the UN has been an international organization functioning over the last 50 years. and has prevented that sort of thing from happening.
But, well, I would argue there are lots of imperfections in the UN. I think you'd probably agree with me. But let me ask you specifically on Sudan. Has there been a resolution presented either in the General Assembly or the Security Council to do something?
They have presented, or they're drafting a resolution now, and the problem that they're stuck on is genocide or no genocide. Kofi Annan and Colin Powell went there. They talked with the leaders of Sudan. They came back, and they're very soft-spoken about it, because if they define it as genocide, then it creates a ripple effect, and the government there will resist any outside intervention.
Well, let's explain.
And the genocide will go on. I think we start with the definition of what is genocide.
Okay.
And it's in the 1948 UN resolution on genocide, and it says it is doing harm to members of a group, and it lists all kinds of ways you can do harm. I mean, killing is one, raping is one, burning the village, moving them from another place to another, preventing death, incarcerating them, preventing birth. All that is a part of genocide, but it has to fulfill two conditions. According to the dictionary, it has to be systematic and intentional. Now, it's certainly systematic, and it's not by accident that they're wiping out those villages. And so it's therefore intentional. But the UN has drawn back from saying it's intentional because they said we don't know what the intention is, and maybe the militias are out of control of the government. But all the observers say that the militias are backed by the army.
Now please explain to our listeners why our Secretary of State Colin Powell and UN Secretary General Kofi Annan would resist calling this what it sure seems to be to the naked eye, genocide. Why do they resist that label?
They're afraid of the Sudanese government that it will actually be counterproductive, and so therefore they're walking on eggshells. Well, I understand that diplomacy, you have to do that, and I do believe that these two gentlemen are sincerely want to help the people in the South, but their hands are tied by political reasons. And I think that shows essentially a lack of backbone. I mean, at some point, you have to stand up and say what you believe.
Well, I think it may also be because there is are treaty obligations in the United Nations and the United States. We have signed treaties informing the United Nations that obligate us to act in case of genocide. Isn't that true, Mr.
Yes, and that will not be invoked in all probability because of operational issues connected with the Pentagon and its war in Iraq.
So because we're overstretched in Iraq, we won't call a spade, we won't call genocide genocide, because to do that would obligate us to act, and our politicians don't want to act.
I had a discussion yesterday with several Sudanese gentlemen and officials of NGOs who had just come from Sudan in the south, and they said it's the most horrendous situation you can imagine, even though they've seen a lot of it. And the what is coming out of those discussions is the hopelessness or the helplessness of the international organization. Did you know there are only 9 NGOs that are working in Darfur right now? All the talk.
9 international organizations.
Yes. And
now, is that because it's dangerous for them? I mean, you mentioned that you were kidnapped by a death squad. What happened to you, and should other people fear helping out?
Unfortunately, I spoke Arabic, and I talked my way out of it 20 minutes, so I was blue in the face, and they finally said, here, get out of here. But they wouldn't give me my camera or anything they took out of my pockets, and they started beating other people instead of me. And I said, no, I want my stuff back, and they finally gave me my camera and my passport back. But, yes, it's very insecure there. Now, some of these people are real anti-militarists, but they were advocating intervention because to save so many lives. But, you know, you have to look at it realistically. The military analysts say there are 15 or 20,000 troops would be necessary to secure Darfur province. But nobody's going to send that many troops. It costs too much money. And they're not even thinking about it or talking about it. The African Union wants to send 400 troops. The U.S. has 2,000 on standby in the Horn of Africa so that we could put them over there. But 2,000 troops...
Well, what about the other countries?
20,000 would just be cosmetic and would make us feel better, but wouldn't help the people there.
Some of my listeners, some say that the other countries should go first. Others are saying we should lead the rest of the world, frankly, as we did in Bosnia. Remember, when we decided to act in Bosnia, France and Germany and the other countries went along. But why isn't France or Germany or Russia or these other countries that have condemned our actions in Iraq, which I also condemn, by the way, but why haven't these countries who say we need to be working for humanity humanitarian causes, why aren't they sending anyone?
Germany has the best record. I mean, it goes back into 1870 when the Germans were very active in that part of Africa, and they would have more credibility than the U.S. Every observer that I talked with yesterday who had just come from Sudan said, keep the U.S. out of here because it's the resentment is so great
because of the Iraqi
foreign policy. And so it isn't going to really help. It's just going to make things worse if the U.S. So we need to have other nations involved. And
maybe if we had a president that knew how to get international support from the rest of the world, we could help stop this crisis.
Then the history of our country would be different in the last 2 years, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Let me ask you this. I want to give, and I know that the details are gruesome, and you've described some of the rapes, but I want to give people an idea of what's actually going on down there. You said that the government was actually dropping bombs on these villages. Is that right?
That's right. They go. That's the anecdotal
just to kill people?
Testimony by the victim. Is that often the planes will come in and bomb them, and then the horsemen, Janjaweed militias, they're called, will come in and do the mopping up operation by which they will kill and rape. They have destruction of villages, burning the houses, looting the livestock, killing the men, raping the women, poisoning the wells, and it's mainly directed at these three ethnic groups of Fur, Masalit, and Zagawa, and they're actually in the sort of the western part even of the Darfur province. So it's how do you deal with these kind of things when the government denies that they're in charge of the militias? But the man who came from Sudan that I talked with yesterday said everybody he talked with in Khartoum said that they know that the government is behind it, but there is some truth in the fact that once you unleash these militias, the raiding parties, that the government is not able to control everything they do either. So between those two issues, there has to be a settlement. I think also one of the key factors is that this is a spinoff in some ways of the rivalry between the politicians in Khartoum. And that's
really explain
that thing to find that they are having people killed and they don't care as long as their own power is.
Well, explain to me what's going on. So there are two factions in the capital of Khartoum in the government, and why is the government supporting just these? I mean, they're just bombing villages, right?
It goes into the radical Islamist theorist,
okay.
Hassan al-Tarabi.
Explain
and,
that.
He initially backed Omar al-Bashir, the military man who took power in the coup of 1989. And is still the strong man. And then they fell out, and Bashir had Tarabi imprisoned. And he was in prison for quite a while. Then he was released, formed his own political parties. But now you have these two parties in the south called the SLA, Sudan Liberation Army, in Darfur, not the same one as the SPLA. And then the JEM, which is the Justice and Equality Movement, formed. These two armies took up arms in February of 2003 against the central government. And that's what started. It was an insurrection or uprising, and of course, any government's going to put it down.
Okay, but just to be clear, this has been going on for some 20 years, going back to 83 before these liberation movements started up.
So. Yeah, even the former president Sadiq al-Mahdi sent out these armed guerrillas and told them, okay, go and take slaves or whatever. And this kind of thing went on. So it's part of the landscape, part of the background in Sudan. And it's terrible because if you go to Sudan and meet the people, I tell you, these are the nicest, gentlest, loveliest people on earth. They're very hospitable. But when you get into a situation where the villages are being burned and these ideologues are saying, Omar al-Bashir is God and you don't practice Ramadan, so we're going to kill you. That's ideology, which is terrible.
Okay, we have to go to another break. But when we come back, I want to ask what really can be done. You know, is it sanctions? Is it military action? What do you propose doing, Mr. Jennings? And what can our listeners do if they care about the situation? And if you want to write, of course, all you have to do is send me an email to comment@radioinsidescoop.com. Also, I have a whole web blog on this and other subjects at www.radioinsidescoop.com. Feel free to add your comment to the ongoing dialogue. And certainly we welcome your calls. The number is toll-free, 877-57-SCOOP. There are no stupid questions. Call toll-free, 877-57-SCOOP. We appreciate your calls. We'll be right back with more of the Inside Scoop right after this.
listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
And I'm Sarah Turner.
Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan, in his semi-annual testimony before the Senate Banking Committee, Greenspan said, "We are creating a problem that has to be addressed." He created a stir when he agreed with Democratic campaign statements that there is a growing gap in wages based on skill level. Greenspan said that upper-level income households have benefited more from the economic recovery than anyone else. He said the effect of increasing concentration of incomes is not desirable in a democratic society. While the Democrats blame President Bush's tax cuts for the disparity, Greenspan blames education.
Pilot salaries at Delta Airlines took a major nosedive on Tuesday after the union was forced to increase its proposed wage cut from 13.5% to 23%. And Delta says that still may not be enough to avoid filing bankruptcy. The airline posted its worst financial record in 25 years and wants pilots to take a 30% cut in wages and, quote, increase their productivity.
On Monday, the U.S. Justice Department gave $500,000 to a Mexican and U.S. coalition for use in fighting the importation of underage sex slaves in Southern California. The Bilateral Safety Corridor Coalition is made up of more than 70 member organizations in both San Diego County and Tijuana, Mexico. The coalition says that young women and boys are lured from Latin America and Eastern European countries to Mexico. They are then trained and sold. Many times they are sent to work in hidden brothels on farms throughout San Diego County where they are forced to service the workers.
Was Dick Cheney doing business with terrorists? Federal prosecutors will put that question to a grand jury this week as they subpoena documents from oil services giant Halliburton regarding its Iranian operations from 1995 through 2000. Cheney was the chief executive at Halliburton during those years while Iran was under sanctions for supposed ties to terrorist activity. Halliburton is facing at least 5 separate investigations for illegal corporate conduct, including bribery in Nigeria, also while Cheney was chief executive.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. According to the Non-Governmental Bureau of National Affairs, unions won 58% of the 1,348 government-monitored workplace elections in 2003, the highest success rate for unions since BNA began watching them some 2 decades ago. Fewer union elections overall were held in 2003 compared to the year before, meaning that while the success rate is growing, the actual number of electoral victories are declining. This corresponds well to shrinking union membership rates in the overall workforce.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Welcome back to Mark Levine's Inside Scoop on Washington, bringing you all the news from the nation's capital and sometimes around the world that the administration does not want you to know. I'm your host, Mark Levine, and we've gotten some emails here that I want to read out. And, of course, you're always welcome to call at 877-57-SCOOP. Coming up at the end of the hour, I'm going to talk about the Bush administration push on Pakistan to capture Osama bin Laden during the Democratic National Convention. That's coming up in the last 5 minutes. But for now, we're talking about the most grievous humanitarian situation in the world, the ongoing genocide going on in Sudan, the largest country in Africa, and what we and others are really not doing about it. My guest is Jim Jennings, the president and founder of Conscious International. Mr. Jennings, I have an email here that says, "The mindset of genocide is an interesting concept. All war has the seed of this malevolence. The enemy is always deemed subhuman. In Vietnam, I killed gooks and dinks, not spirit-indwelt creatures who loved or want love. I wonder what our GIs call Iraqis today. I'm sure they have plenty of derogatory terms for their opponents. And what labels do the Sudanese opponents have for each other?" Can you answer that question?
The testimony that I've seen says that the quotes that come out of their mouth is, "You are slaves and we can do anything we want with you." In other words, sort of a subhuman level or lower than we, the northerners, are.
So they actually believe, it sounds like they actually believe that the other human beings in southern Sudan are a slave class or caste.
Yes.
And should willingly submit to slavery.
Yes.
So this is, in essence, a war, at least in the mind. Now, I understand the government is using all kinds of things to stay in power, but in the minds of the people fighting this war, this is a war over whether or not to enslave people. Is that fair to say?
I think it's even more than that. I think it goes into ethnic cleansing. And so, of course, if they can get slaves and sell them for money, they will. If they can keep them for sex slaves, they will. And this has been documented.
So it's more. It's even worse, if you will, than the northern Sudanese trying to enslave the southern Sudanese. But in fact, they actually just want to wipe them out.
Yeah, they've been a scorched earth policy. The government launched this ruthless counterinsurgency campaign in April of 2003, and they used these Janjaweed, or the mounted horsemen, as their militias to do it. And then they said, "Oh, our hands are clean. We didn't do anything." Well, that won't go. It won't work.
Now, the mounted horsemen, do they ride into villages shooting everyone? Or what do they do?
Yeah, they have a lot of weapons, and this is. Actually, this kind of raid has gone on in Sudan for maybe hundreds of years, but it's minor and small, and it has died out pretty much in the modern period until this happened. What they've done is arm them. They have to get those arms from somewhere. They've got pretty sophisticated weapons, and they go in and shoot them up, and of course the people in the village don't have anything, and they have to run. If they run into the bush, they chase them and then kill them and rape the women.
Now, are there, like, pits of people? Are there big burial sites, as we saw in Cambodia? How are all these people being buried?
Unfortunately, I don't know the answer to that, but I don't think that a lot of them are buried. They're just shot and left lying. But,
wow.
But when the village has to be depopulated, then the people just flee. There are some villages where they have closed them around about and won't let the people come out. If they come out, they kill them. And so it's different in different places,
Mr. Jennings,
and it's worse in some place than others.
I have not seen pictures from Sudan. I have not seen television images, or I think I've seen an occasional photograph in the newspaper. Is CNN down there? Is Fox News, MSNBC? Is the BBC down there? And if not, why not? And then do you think that pictures of what's going on, if people actually saw, you know, the fields of bodies dead in the streets, do you think that might change public opinion?
About 2 months ago, when you were doing your first program on Sudan, Christian Amanpour went to Chad and did a story about the refugees there, and it was very, very well done. And I've seen one from BBC and others also. So there is some awareness of this. But again, it really depends on the public perception and the political will, because if people are interested in other things, like baseball scores, they won't be interested in seeing this. So I think it's a challenge to advocate for these victims. Then you have to, the NGOs like Conscience International, our own organization, we have to deal with the Khartoum government. Fortunately, we have very high contacts with the government there, and we will make a mission there, but I want to see what's on the ground in Darfur first before we go and confront them with the evidence. The organizations like this have to worry about security, logistics, the rains, the size of the area. Imagine an area the size of California with no roads. How are you going to get around in that?
Well, don't you have to be a little circumspect about what you say? I mean, I don't think the Sudanese government monitors my radio program, but you know, obviously you're not real pleased with the Sudanese government, neither am I. Is there a fear that if you speak out too loudly, you won't be given access to help people?
That's always the case, and some very large organizations have said that their policy is to keep their mouth shut because they don't want to get in trouble, so they have to avoid. And the only way to do it, I think, is that all the NGOs, non-governmental organizations, should be form a coalition, and they should all say the same thing at the same time. That way the government can't really, punish any one particular one or co-opt them.
So is it your view that the media is down in Sudan and doing a sufficient job? I wasn't sure when you mentioned, okay, Christian Amanpour, I praise her. She did a good job. You mentioned the BBC. I still haven't seen very much on my news channel. Am I missing something?
No, you've got it exactly right. They're not doing a thorough enough job in covering this. And again, it all comes down to money and budgets. And how many people care about what's happening in sub-Saharan Africa?
Well, that's interesting to me. You're not saying it's about safety, which is what I guess I thought you were going to say. It's really about just money and budget. CNN is budgeting 100 times more in Iraq than in Sudan?
Yeah, I mean, when I was in Afghanistan, you should have seen the CNN. Of course, I've been on CNN and interviewed on CNN a number of times, but in Afghanistan, they had a huge number of crews there doing their work. And in Iraq as well, I've met some of the reporters there. But when you ask about, and this is not just CNN, this is all the news organizations, when you ask about who's covering Africa, well, is a guy up in Paris, and he comes down when they need to send him.
He's not even in Africa.
Sort of that. I mean, that,
and I don't mean to pick just on CNN.
That's typical of news organizations.
Frankly, I think CNN's probably one of the best. But you know, if we can't expect it, if CNN doesn't do it, then clearly Fox News or MSNBC won't cover it. CNN doesn't. I would think they'd have people on the ground in Africa, don't they?
Yeah, they do have. But again, it depends on where you put the emphasis and where you put the money. And, of course, I think the only way Fox News would cover it is if it would distract from the mess that President Bush has made in Iraq.
Let me read you an email from one of my favorite listeners, Rod in New York City. He writes, "Where is the outrage from the UN General Assembly? Oh, yeah, they're busy decrying Israel's treatment of the martyr brigade ranks. There are scarce few brave enough in the Arab leadership to offer any help or comment on the situation. Bush has done nothing to offer the world in the way of international policy. His currency is so low, it can only serve to further inflame and degrade the situation. I'm afraid we're going to have to dump W before we as a nation can expect to move meaningfully toward fighting this abhorrent, murderous regime in Sudan. We can only hope that the media will return to their mandate as the fourth estate and tell the world to heed the words, never again." That's very well put, Rod. I would like to ask, Mr. Jennings, you said that there still has not been a single resolution in the General Assembly or the Security Council of the United Nations, who is focusing on all kinds of other things, as Rod mentions. Are Arab countries reluctant to criticize a fellow Arab nation?
We talked about this yesterday among some very experienced workers in the area, and it was agreed that it's not just the Arab nations, but every nation is going to color the picture the way that best suits them, and so therefore they will overlook maybe crimes against humanity if it's done by some of their ethnic group, but they won't overlook it if it's done by another ethnic group. So, and I think that's a sad commentary on human nature.
So you think that correct me if I'm wrong, you're saying that Islamic leaders are overlooking genocide because it's being done by Muslims?
Well, in some ways you may talk with, and I've talked with many of these leaders in most of the Middle Eastern countries, and many of them are very candid about it, and they're very humane. They want to do the right thing, perhaps, but they are afraid of sometimes of their own extremists among their people, not their people, but their own extremists who may number, you know, a high percentage, a relatively high percentage in the population. One of the things that the so-called war on terror, which is not really that at all, but that so-called invasion of Iraq has done, is it has fallen into the hands of the al-Qaeda-type people and increased their number of recruits greatly and increased the danger to the United States. If you know anything about the area, you'll be sure of that. So many of those leaders, they might be sympathetic to the United States, but they don't want to say it because there's a 1% approval rating of the United States among many of the Middle Eastern, North African countries right now.
I have to tell you, Mr. Jennings, I certainly support what you're doing, and I agree on most everything you've said, but we may disagree here. I frankly think it's an excuse of Arab leaders. I particularly look at the leadership in Saudi Arabia that has so much money and so much wealth, and they say, oh, well, we have to pay off and support these radical Islamic teachers that are teaching hatred of so much kind. We have to do it because we're afraid they're going to overthrow us. It's true. You should be afraid they're going to overthrow you, but I don't think that ever justifies either teaching the hatred that's going out from their schools or simply doing nothing just because people of your own countrymen are committing genocide. I think that excuse is a little too easy, and I at least don't accept it. We may disagree on that.
I don't really disagree with that. I think that when September 11th happened, I said, look in Saudi Arabia, look in Egypt, and look in Pakistan at what's happening.
I couldn't agree with you more.
It's not surprising that those things happened out of those populations. And why did they happen in those populations? And you go back and review.
Because we are supporting Arab dictators
in the region,
right,
for many years.
Right, we are supporting Arab dictators that are mistreating their people, and that's a lot of the harsh. That's what creates and fuels radical Islam. Mr. Jennings, we only have a few minutes left, and I did want to give an inside scoop at the end. As a last question, let me ask you what you think is the best response. Is it sanctions? Is it military action? What can people do? What should the UN do? What should the U.S. do? What do you think is the proper response to this?
Number one, the international community must stay engaged and focused on this, and it means that all governments and all non-governmental organizations must increase their pledges of money to help that area. The Conscience International website is CONSCIENCE, international, one word, .org. And that gives you an idea of what we do. But there are other organizations that you should support as well. But we need to increase activity there. And then there are a lot of things that the Sudanese government should do if we can only convince them and get them to do it.
Well, how do we convince them? Is it sanctions? Is it a threat of military
action? No, I don't believe in sanctions or military action as the best way to deal with people. I have been to, for example, in Iraq before the war, had access to the high-level people, and the Tariq Aziz, for example, and you can talk to these people and you can influence them, aside from dropping bombs on them and creating a worse situation. Sanctions killed hundreds of thousands of children in Iraq during that time, and one of the reasons for the insurgency now is that the Iraqi people know that the U.S. is not on their side, otherwise they wouldn't have done that to them for so many years. So, but if we could just hammer away at the leaders in Khartoum, to cease these attacks, disband the militias, punish the guilty. The African Union has said there should be no impunity for anybody who committed these crimes. And above all, do not recruit these Janjaweed guerrillas, men on horseback, into the army, and don't force people to return back unless it's safe. But we, you know, only 19% of the needs of the refugees that have fled are being met at this point. And the rains have started to get, how do you get in through no roads in that big area? So we have lots of problems about this, but we shouldn't stop working on it.
Mr. Jennings, I want to thank you very much for coming here on the Inside Scoop.
Indeed. Thank you, Mark.
Well, you heard it. You heard the extent of the problem. You heard the extent of the danger. I have to say I agree with everything Mr. Jennings said until the last thing. I think that we can agree on the problem and disagree on the solution. I don't think, obviously, we should do everything verbally to pressure Sudan to do the right thing. That goes to me without saying. Every country should do that. We should use the United Nations. We should put forward a resolution before the Security Council. As Rod pointed out, they're too busy focused on Israel, I think, to focus on some real humanitarian, really the worst humanitarian concerns in the world. But words may not be enough, and in my mind, I think we should go after them. Start with sanctions. You always start with the low level. War is always the last resort. But sanctions and even the threatened use of force, I think, is necessary. Look, I am not a pacifist. Neither am I a warmonger. I think you know, you've listened to me, that I opposed the war in Iraq. I did not think it was justified. But sometimes I think war is justified, and to me, in my mind, genocide is one of those times. And I don't believe in rushing to war. Like I said, I think you do sanctions, and I think the people understand. Listen, we did sanctions in South Africa, and the blacks understood that even though it was hard on them, that it actually helped bring down their government. Sanctions were actually were hard on the Iraqis, but I think we're damaging to Saddam Hussein. I do disagree to some extent with Mr. Jennings on that. But I think you begin with sanctions, and then you actually threaten the use of force. And this is a time when the use of force is absolutely justified. It was justified in Bosnia. If you want to comment on what I've just said, hey, feel free. You don't have to agree with me. That's what America is all about. You can post a comment on the blog for all to hear by writing to www.radioinsidescoop.com. Or if you want to call in some future show and take issue with me, I always welcome that. We got 2 minutes left, and I promised I would give you the inside scoop on a present that the administration is trying to get from Pakistan during the Democratic National Convention. According to this, there's a terrific article in the New Republic that explains what's going on. According to one source in Pakistan's inter-service intelligence, quote, the Pakistani government is really desperate and wants to flush out bin Laden and his associates after the latest pressures from the U.S. administration to deliver before the upcoming U.S. elections. Now, obviously, I have no problem getting Osama bin Laden. I've been arguing that for some time. But the officials there made it clear there was no timetable in 2002 and none in 2003. But four different sources, not just this one, there's another source that Pakistanis have been told at every level that apprehension or killing of high-value targets, that's the leaders of al-Qaeda, before the election is an absolute must. And according to another ISI official from the Pakistani Secret Intelligence, quote, a White House aide told this person, Ul-Haq is his name, Lieutenant General Ehsan Ul-Haq, a White House aide told Ul-Haq last spring that, quote, it would be best if the arrest or killing of Osama bin Laden and other leaders of al-Qaeda were announced on 26th, 27th, or 28th of July, the first 3 days of the Democratic National Convention in Boston. Now, I obviously completely support capturing and killing the leaders of al-Qaeda, but this push by the government to do it during the Democratic National Convention, to me, smacks of all of politics. And I want to talk about that in detail when we discuss next week the Democratic National Convention, because it's on next week. You can say bring it on, the entire convention in Boston, and we are devoting next week to the Democratic National Convention. We're going to talk about the speeches each day. We're going to talk about your impressions of John Kerry, John Edwards, the other speeches you see. Election Tuesday, I'll be arguing with some Republican about what's going on at the convention. Let's talk about the Democratic National Convention in Boston. Let's get people energized. Let's find out what you like or don't like about our Democratic nominee, John Kerry and John Edwards. And let's talk about what's going on behind the convention, things like this story about the push in Pakistan, which I'll give you more details on next week. So please, do not miss the Inside Scoop next week, 3 o'clock Eastern Time, 2 Central, 1 Mountain, noon Pacific. And if you like the Inside Scoop,